You're listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. I'm reading the cycle of lectures entitled Life Between Death and Rebirth by Rudolf Steiner. This is Lecture 8. When we observe human life in connection with life in the rest of the world, with the vision ordinarily used for man's outward existence, we are considering really only the smallest portion of what is related to man himself. In other words, all that can be seen without penetrating behind the secrets of existence really explains nothing about ourselves. For when we employ the ordinary human organs of perception and thought, we have before us only that which lacks the deepest and most important secrets of existence. This is seen most clearly when we develop, even to a comparatively small degree, the capacity to view life and the world from the other side, namely from sleep. What can be seen in sleep is hidden from the vision of most people, for as soon as a person falls asleep, and during the whole time which elapses until he awakes, he really sees nothing. When the time comes in his evolution that he can also make observations when asleep, he sees first and primarily what relates to himself, although this is entirely hidden from his everyday observation. It is easy to perceive that it must remain hidden from his everyday consciousness, for the brain is the instrument of judging, thought, etc. In ordinary life, we make use of the brain, which we wish to think, when we wish to think and judge. At least we then set the brain into activity, but we cannot thereby observe life any more than the eye can see itself when it makes an observation. This is fundamentally the case as regards the entire man. We are clothed by this, but we cannot observe it or penetrate into it. Now, the greatest secrets of existence are not outside, in the world, but are within man. Let us recapitulate what we know from spiritual science. We know that the three kingdoms of nature surrounding us really present stages of evolution that have remained behind. The mineral, vegetable, and animal kingdoms consist of beings which are as they are because something has remained behind in evolution. Normal progress in evolution has really only been made by that living principle which is participating in human existence during this earthly period. When man observes mineral, vegetable, or animal life, he really observes in the world around him what corresponds in his own life to the embodiments of his memory. When a person reflects upon what he remembers, on what he has experienced in his soul, he is considering something which has taken place in the past and which still enjoys a certain existence. When he devotes himself merely to what is in his memory, he is not observing the living, invisible, present soul life. Memory, with all its contents, represents something which has consolidated in our living soul life, something which is in it as a form. Naturally, all these things are pictorially expressed. But that which is embodied in the soul life as memory is not the immediate, elemental, present existence of the soul. The case is the same outside man in nature, in the mineral, vegetable, and animal kingdoms. In these kingdoms dwell the thoughts of divine spiritual beings, which were thought in the past, and they continue into the living existence of the present, as our memory ideas continue in our soul existence. Hence, in the world around us, we do not see the thoughts of the present, immediate, living, divine, spiritual beings, but we see the memory ideas of the gods, the thoughts of the gods, which have been preserved. It is interesting to observe the contents of our memory, because from this example we may comprehend to a certain extent the creation of the world. By seeing a minute portion of what takes place, we may gain understanding of how things pass over from creation into existence. That which exists in our own soul as memory, as ideas in the memory, is the lowest stage, as it were, of what has been created, the very first, most evanescent stage of what has been created. But when a person awakens spiritually in sleep, he sees something else. He does not see what is outside in space. He does not see the processes we usually see in the mineral, vegetable, and animal kingdoms, or in the outer human kingdom. But he is aware that the most essential thing he then sees is the creative and animating element in man himself. It is really as if everything else were blotted out, and the earth which he then observes from the point of view of sleep contained only man. That which is never seen during the day in the waking condition is revealed when one observes the world from the point of view of sleep. Then one first really comes to know the thoughts which the divine spiritual beings have stored up in order to pass beyond mineral, vegetable, and animal life, and work creatively on man. Whereas by physical vision of the world around we see everything else except man, through spiritual vision, from the point of view of sleep, we do not see everything else but really only man. Hence the preliminary strangeness of the vision we have when we observe the world from the point of view of sleep. That is, when we become clairvoyant during sleep, when we waken spiritually. The human body, and I am now considering as human body that which during sleep lies on the bed, namely physical body and etheric body together, this human body itself then presents a unique appearance, the characteristic of which may be expressed in words somewhat as follows. Only in the first years of childhood is this sleeping human body, similar in a certain respect to the life and activity in the other kingdoms of nature. But the body of an adult, or even of a child from a certain age, presents, when seen from the standpoint of sleep, a process which is really a continual process of decay or destruction. It is true that all night during sleep, the destructive forces are again killed by the forces of growth. What is made good during the night is destroyed during the day. But there is always a surplus of destructive force, and the final result of this is that we die. The surplus which remains gradually collects. Every night there is a surplus. The forces replaced during the night are never so great as those used up in the life of the day, so that in the normal life of man there is every day a certain residue of destructive force. And as this remainder is added each day to the rest, the natural death of old age ensues, when the sum of destructive forces has become so great that it overcomes the constructive ones. When we observe man from the point of view of sleep, we really see a destructive process taking place. We do not look upon this destructive process with sadness, for when seen from the point of view of sleep, we do not have the feelings regarding it which we might have in our day life, because we know that this destructive process is necessary for the true spiritual development of man. No being which did not destroy its body could think or develop an inner soul life. It would be quite impossible for a soul life, such as man possesses, to be developed merely through processes of growth, if these were not opposed by processes of destruction. Therefore, we view these destructive processes in the human organism as the necessary conditions of human soul life, and we feel the whole process as a blessing. From the other side of life, we even feel with bliss the fact of our being able gradually to disintegrate our body. Not only does it look different from the other side of life, but our feelings and views are also different. From the standpoint of the consciousness of sleep, we always have before us the body which is disintegrating. When, on the other hand, we consider life between death and rebirth, we have something else before us. For some time after death, there is a certain kind of life which is connected with the previous life. This is clear to you as regards the period in Kamaloka, but it also lasts for some time after. During this period, one lives with the previous life. Then comes a moment, which always enters in the life between death and rebirth, a moment when there is actually a reversal of all ordinary vision and perception in a much higher sense than during sleep consciousness, a reversal for the following reason. When we are here in earthly existence, we look from our body into the other world, which is not exactly our body. From the time I have just mentioned between death and rebirth, one really looks very little at the surrounding world, at the universe, but one looks all the more at what might now be called the human body. One learns all its secrets. There comes, therefore, a period between death and rebirth when one begins to be especially interested in the human body. It is extremely difficult to explain these conditions, and it can really only be done with halting words. There comes a period between death and rebirth when one feels, as regards the whole cosmos, as if one had this universe within oneself, that outside there is only the human body. Just as one feels with respect to the stomach, the liver, the spleen, that they are within, so in the same way, from the time of which we are speaking, one feels the stars and the rest of the worlds in general to be within one's own being. What in our life here is outside is then really our inner world. And just as we now look on the stars, the clouds, etc., we then look upon the human body. But upon which human body? If we wish to know which human body we then see, we must clearly understand that that which enters into existence at a fresh birth as a new human being is being prepared in its essential nature long before birth. It is not at birth or conception that this human being begins to send itself again to live on the earth, but long before. Things are entirely different with regard to this from what statistical biology supposes. For it is supposed that when a person enters into existence at birth, he receives certain characteristics by heredity from father, mother, grandfather, etc., back through the whole line of ancestry. There is a very neat little book on Goethe in which Goethe's characteristics are traced back to his ancestors. Now, in the external sense, this is quite correct, in the sense I have so often mentioned, namely that there is absolutely no contradiction between any natural scientific fact correctly stated and the facts revealed by spiritual science. The relationship between them may be characterized as follows. Someone may say, here is a human being. How is it that he is alive? Then someone else may reply, I know why he is alive. It is because he possesses lungs within and because there is air outside. That is obviously correct. But another may come and say, this person is alive for an entirely different reason. A fortnight ago he fell into the water. I jumped in and pulled him out. That is why he is alive. For if I had not jumped in and rescued him, he would not now be alive. This assertion is quite correct, and so is the other one. It is quite right to prove by outer science that someone possesses traits inherited from his ancestors, but it is also correct when we refer to his karma and to other things. In principle, spiritual science cannot be intolerant. In principle, only outer science is intolerant by rejecting spiritual science. Thus, someone may say that he has preserved within him the characteristics of his ancestors. But alongside this, there is also the fact that at a certain stage between death and rebirth, he begins to develop forces which work down upon his ancestors. Long before a human being enters into physical existence, he is mysteriously connected with his whole line of ancestors. And the reason why certain qualities appear in a line of ancestry is that from this line, perhaps only after centuries, a certain man is to be born. From the spiritual world, this human being, who is to proceed from a certain line of ancestors, it may be centuries hence, regulates the qualities of his ancestors. Goethe, therefore, if we may once more refer to this example, manifested the traits of his ancestors, because from the spiritual world he had continuously worked at implanting his qualities in his ancestors, and as Goethe did, so does every man. From a certain definite time between death and rebirth, therefore, man is engaged in preparing his next earthly existence. The physical body which a person possesses here on earth does not, by any means, depend altogether upon the physical life of his ancestors, nor upon processes which take place on the earth. Our physical body is really a fourfold structure. We have developed this physical body through the Saturn, Sun, Moon, and Earth periods. The first foundations of it were laid upon ancient Saturn. During the Sun period, the etheric body was woven into this. During the Moon period, the astral body. And during the Earth period, the ego. Through these additions, the physical body has been changed again and again. We have, therefore, within us the transformed Saturn foundation, the transformed Sun conditions, and the transformed Moon conditions. The only part of all this that is visible is what we have derived from the Earth. The other parts are invisible. The physical body of man becomes visible through his having absorbed the substances of the Earth, transformed them in his blood, and pervaded with this blood a part that is invisible. In reality, we see only the blood and the results of its transforming activity. That is, we see only one-fourth of the human physical body. The other three-fourths are invisible. To begin with, there exists an invisible scaffolding, and within this are invisible currents, which exist as forces. Within these invisible currents, there are again invisible activities of the several currents upon one another. None of this is yet visible, and now this threefold invisible part is filled out by food which has been changed into blood. Only through this process does the physical body become visible, and it is only when we come to the laws of this visible part that we reach the realm which originated from what belongs to the earth. The rest does not originate from earthly conditions, but from cosmic conditions. It has already been prepared when conception takes place, and the first physical atom of man comes into existence. That which is later to become the body of man has been prepared previously, without any physical union with father and mother. The conditions dependent on heredity are only worked in afterward. The human soul looks down upon this, which is being prepared as the spiritual embryo, or spiritual germ of life. And from the special period between death and rebirth already mentioned, this comprises its outer world. Note the difference between the time when man wakens clairvoyantly in sleep and sees the fading human body. When he sees this human body undergoing a continual process of destruction, and compare it with the time when he sees the inner members of his being as his outer world. The inner, evolving human being is then his outer world. Thus he sees the reverse of what he sees clairvoyantly during sleep. During sleep he feels his inner members as his outer world, and he sees the gradual destruction of the human body. In the period between death and rebirth, from the time we have mentioned, he looks at the developing human body, at the human body which is advancing toward existence. Man is, however, unable to remember what he sees between death and rebirth. Truly, what he then sees as the construction of that masterpiece, the human body, is more magnificent than all he beholds when he looks at the starry heavens, or at anything in the outer physical world with the ordinary vision of the physical body. The secrets of existence are great, even when we observe them only from the standpoint of sense. But what we see with clairvoyant vision, when we look at what we possess within us, and then at the developing human body with all its secrets, is far greater. We then see everything is prepared, how everything is prepared, and given tendencies, in order at length to lay hold of physical existence when the time arrives for man to enter the physical world at birth. Now there is nothing which may in reality be called bliss, except the vision of the process of creation, the process of becoming. The observation of something that already exists is nothing as compared with the vision of what is evolving. And the bliss which man feels between death and rebirth is really connected with the circumstance that at that time he can see that which is in process of becoming. The lines in Goethe's Faust, in the prologue in Heaven, relate to things such as these which have passed through the revelations of the ages and which have entered the minds of those sufficiently prepared. Quote, "Eternal growth that works and faileth not, within love's golden bars ever enfold you, in wavering apparition with doth which what doth float, bodied in thought, unperishing, uphold you." I'm going to read that again. "Eternal growth that works and faileth not, within love's golden bars ever enfold you, in wavering apparition what doth float, bodied in thought, unperishing, uphold you." End of quote. The difference between our view in this world and in the world between death and rebirth is that here we see existence and there we see the becoming. Someone might now perhaps think, quote, "Then man is only occupied with looking at his own body," close quote. That is not so. For at the stage of becoming, this body is really the outer world, not his own body. It is the expression of divine mysteries. One then begins to realize, keeping in mind the whole of this process of vision, why the physical body, which in truth man only maltreats between birth and death, is the temple of cosmic mysteries. We then possess as inner world that which now is outer world, that which we now call universe is then what we may call ego. That which we then look at is outer world. But one must not raise the objection that one sees one's own body, that is, the body which is to become one's own body, and that naturally all other developing bodies must be there as well. That has nothing to do with it. It has nothing to do with it because, here again, it is purely a question of multiplication. A differentiation between human bodies, which can interest us and which can be important, really begins only a comparatively short time before human beings enter into physical existence. During most of the time between death and rebirth, when one thus looks down at the human body, which is in process of becoming, the separate bodies are only distinguished numerically, and this is also correctly transferred to one's own experience, to one's feelings. If we wish to study a grain of wheat, it really does not make much difference whether we go to a field and take a grain from a certain ear, or whether we go 50 steps further and take another grain from an ear there. As regards the essential thing to be observed in a grain of wheat, one grain is just as good as another, and one has this feeling also when one observes one's own body. The fact that it is one's own is really of value only for the future, because one will use it later on the earth. But it is of interest now only as the vehicle of the deepest mysteries of the world, and the bliss consists in one's being able to consider it just like any other human body. At this point we are confronting the mystery of number, which we shall not now expound further, but among many other things that come into consideration with this subject, we may say that number, that is, multiple existence, from the spiritual standpoint, is not perceived in general as it is from the physical standpoint. What is perceived in many examples is, however, perceived again as unity. Through our body we perceive ourselves to be in the universe, and through what in physical life we call universe, we feel ourselves in our I nature. Thus our perception is different when we consider the world at one time from here and at another from there. The most important moment between death and rebirth for the seer is that in which man ceases to occupy himself merely with his last life and begins to look upon what is being developed. The impression the seer gets when he follows a soul's journey between death and rebirth, at the moment the soul begins to enter vividly into that which is developing, is a very violent one, because the soul which is passing through this condition itself experiences a violent shock. This can only be compared to the moment of death here in physical life. When death takes place in physical life, one passes from life into being. there, although this does not describe it quite exactly, because it is not possible to do so, one passes from something which is connected with a former life, which has expired, to a development, to a resurrection. One encounters that which possesses germinally within it an entirely new life. It is the reverse of death. This is extremely important. Now, in connection with this, we must cast a glance over human evolution on the earth. Let us look back to the time when our soul was in the Egypto-Chaldean age, when, looking forth into the world by means of the physical body, it beheld the stars not merely as physically sensible celestial bodies, but when it saw the spiritual beings connected with the stars, although this only took place in certain intermediary conditions in the life between birth and death. This had an effect on the soul, which at that time was filled with impressions from the spiritual world. It had to come about, in course of evolution, that the power to see the spiritual should gradually die, and vision be limited to the sensible world. This took place during the Greco-Latin age, when the vision of man was turned more and more away from the spiritual world, and was more and more limited to the world of sense. We are now living in an age when the soul's power to see what is spiritual in the life of the physical world is fading still further. The earth is now in process of decay, and man participates very strongly in this process. Whereas in the Egypto-Chaldean age people still saw spiritual things around them, they now see only the things of sense, and are proud of being able to found a science which comprises only the things of sense. This process will go still further. A time will come when man will lose all interest in the direct impressions of the sense world, and will turn his attention to the sub-sensible world. We can already observe the approach of the time when man will only be interested in the sub-sensible. Very often this appears quite prominently, as for example, when present-day physics no longer studies color. In reality, the physicist no longer studies the quality of color. He prefers to study what is beneath color, what vibrates and oscillates beneath color. At the present time, you may already read in many books such nonsense, for example, as that the color yellow consists of such and such a great number of vibrations of wavelengths. Here, attention has already turned away from the quality of color and directed to that which is not in the color yellow, and which is then imagined to be reality. You may now find books on physics and also on physiology, in which it is said that the direct sense impression should no longer engage our attention, but everything is resolved into vibrations and vibration numbers. This way of studying the world will increase. People will lose their interest in sensible existence, and will wish only to turn their attention to the activities of the forces behind it. We need only draw attention to one thing in order to prove this matter in an empirical historical way. Read the address made by Dubois Raymond on the 14th of August, 1872, on title, quote, "The Limits of the Knowledge of Nature," close quote. There you will find a peculiar expression, one used by Laplace before him, the expression, quote, "the astronomical knowledge of things," close quote. That is, when one represents what lies behind a process of light or color in the same way as that which usually is found, only in a cosmic form. It will happen that human souls will go so far, and those who are now educated in certain schools possess the best foundation for this, for their next incarnation, that they will have to lose true interest in shining color and the world of light, and only inquire into forces and force relationships. People will no longer have any interest in violet and red, but only for such and such wavelengths. This devastation of the inner world of man is something we are now approaching. And anthroposophy exists in order to work against this, to work against it in every direction. For not only are present educational methods producing this devastation of life, but this tendency exists in every domain of life. There is a certain contrast to ordinary life, when, in spiritual science, we wish to give to souls that which makes them fruitful again, something which comes not only from the Maya of sense, for we wish to give again to human souls that which streams forth as spirit. This we can do when we are able to give them what will enable them to live again in the true world in succeeding incarnations. Thus we have to declare these things in a world which in its indifference to form and color makes such a contrast to that which we desire. For it is particularly in regard to color that the world of the present day is preparing souls to work against what we desire. We must work not only with conceptions and ideas, but we must work with world ideas. For this reason, it is not merely a predilection on our part when we make such surroundings for ourselves as those in this room, but it is connected with the whole nature of spiritual science. In the soul there must reawaken the possibility of feeling directly that which is presented to the senses, so that from this may spring forth again in the soul the active life in the spirit. At present in this incarnation, each one of us can take up spiritual science, each can accept it with his soul and work upon it with his soul. What he now receives into his soul is added to the foundations of his next incarnation. When therefore he passes through the period between death and his next birth, he sends from his soul into his developing body that which prepares his bodily disposition to view the world again in a more spiritual way. He cannot do this if he does not take up spiritual science or anthroposophy. For if he does not, he then prepares his body to see nothing but barren conditions, to have no longer an eye for the sense world. EYE, eye for the sense world. We shall now refer to something which enables the seer to arrive at a conclusion concerning the mission of spiritual science. When the seer directs his gaze to the life which souls lead between death and rebirth, to those souls which have already passed the point we have mentioned and are preparing themselves for a future existence while observing the developing body, he can see souls who are looking at a developing body which in their future life will no longer provide them with the possibility of developing the disposition to comprehend the spiritual. For this disposition must have been implanted before birth for it to become actual during life in the physical body. Hence, in the immediate future, people will be born who will lack more and more the disposition to take up spiritual knowledge, as has already been the case with many souls for some time. From the vision of souls who in their previous life have missed the opportunity of receiving spiritual things springs comprehension of the mission of anthroposophy. For though they are indeed observing something which is developing, the terrible thing is that they are looking upon a development which lacks something and must lack it. It is one of the most shattering experiences to see a soul looking at its future incarnation, its future body, looking at an actively budding development, but a development of which he is obliged to say, something will be wanting in it. What it lacks, I cannot give it, because this depends upon my previous incarnation. In a small way, it may be compared with having to work at something which one knows must be imperfect, which one is condemned to make imperfect. Try to realize the comparison. You can either make this work perfect and have pleasure in your work, or you can be condemned from the very beginning to make it imperfect. The great question is, shall human souls be condemned more and more to look down on bodies which must remain imperfect, or shall they not? If they are not to be condemned to this, they must receive the message of the spiritual worlds here, during life, in physical bodies. That which is regarded as their mission by those who announce the message of the spiritual worlds is not taken from mere earthly ideals, nor does it spring from any earthly ideal, but from a vision of the whole of life, that life which is presented to us when to earthly life is added the period between death and rebirth. In it we see the possibility of a fruitful future for humanity, but also the possibility of working toward the devastation of the human soul. From this wider vision, we get a feeling which says to us, spiritual science or anthroposophy must come. It must exist in the world. True, spiritual science is that without which humanity in the future cannot endure, but not in the sense that one cannot endure without some other knowledge. Spiritual science is that which gives to man not only conceptions and ideas, but life. The conceptions and ideas of spiritual science received by the soul in one life are life for it in the next, inward vitality and activity. Therefore, what spiritual science gives to man is not merely a life in conceptions and ideas, but it is an elixir of life, a vital force. When one takes up anthroposophy, one should feel it as a necessity of life, not merely as something founded as other societies are founded. This feeling of being vitally transposed into the necessities of existence is the right feeling toward spiritual science or anthroposophy. And we have undertaken these studies of the life between death and rebirth in order, from the other side, to gain the right impulse which can, straightway, give us enthusiasm for spiritual science. The end of Lecture 8.